Welcome to Iris and the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Wednesday, June 15th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's see what the weather forecast looks like today. Areas of storms remain possible early this morning over primarily the northwest half of the area. Farther south, it's been dry so far, but this will likely change later today as the front moves in. Given ample heat and humidity, any storm that redevelops will have the capability of strong wind and large hail. Torrential rainfall could also occur. Once this front passes by later this evening, quiet weather is generally expected tomorrow through Monday. Look for building heat once again by Father's Day into early next week. Looking at the stories on the front page, this is what we have. Grassley and Ernst stay cautious on gun bill. Bartold panel, Trump was detached from reality. More funds sought for CF Museum project. And we begin reading the lead story, which is Body Found in River. Police have tentatively identified man found dead Monday in the Cedar River. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. And it begins with a photograph of men and women standing at the river's edge. And four of them are police officers. Dateline Waterloo. Authorities have recovered a body in their search for a man who disappeared in the Cedar River over the weekend. And they have tentatively identified the victim after going for days without a name because no one reported him missing. The name hasn't been released to the public, and authorities said his identity will be confirmed during an autopsy. No foul play is suspected. The mystery began Friday around 6:30 p.m., as the My Waterloo Days parade was making its way through downtown. Witnesses reported seeing a man enter the water near the 6th Street Bridge, and he began to float downstream and disappeared. Crews with Waterloo Fire Rescue launched an inflatable rapid deployment craft, paying close attention to a low head dam just before the nearby railroad bridge. Firefighters used poles and sonar to probe the length of dam, fearing the turbulence was holding him in place. As firefighters continued their search on Sunday, police began working to determine whom they were looking for. If anyone had been with the missing man when he went in the river, they hadn't bothered to stick around. The missing man appeared to be Hispanic, according to initial reports. So over the weekend, investigators contacted Hispanic community leaders and church officials in hopes of coming up with a name. The one clue they had was a blue polo-style shirt with an orange moose logo the man had left behind. And officers posted a photo of the shirt on Facebook. Waterloo Fire Rescue returned to the river on Monday, launching a flat-bottom boat from the Hawthorne Avenue ramp that scoured the area downstream. About 2:15 p.m., boat crews spotted a body some 150 miles past Waterloo's wastewater treatment plant. The body had snagged on something underwater, and firefighters brought the body ashore. Earlier on Monday, a landlord contacted police after recognizing the moose shirt as possibly belonging to a former tenant. Investigators matched documented tattoos with those on the recovered body. The next story comes to the Courier by way of the Associated Press. Barr told panel, Trump detached from reality. Dateline Washington. Donald Trump's closest campaign advisors, top government officials, and even his family were dismantling his false claims of 2020 election fraud ahead of January 6th. But the disgraced former president was becoming detached from reality and clinging to outlandish theories to stay in power. The committee investigating the Capitol attack was told on Monday. With gripping testimony, the panel is laying out in step-by-step fashion how Trump ignored his own campaign team's data as one state after another flipped to Joe Biden, and instead latched on to conspiracy theories, court cases, and his own declarations of victory rather than having to admit defeat. Trump's big lie of election fraud escalated and transformed into marching orders that summoned supporters to Washington and then sent them to the Capitol on January 6th to block Biden's victory. Quote, He's become detached from reality if he really believes this stuff, said former Attorney General William Barr, who called the voting fraud claims bogus and idiotic and resigned in the aftermath. Quote, I didn't want to be part of it, unquote. The House 1-6 committee spent the morning hearing, delving into Trump's false claims of election fraud and the countless ways those around him tried to convince the disgraced former Republican president that they were not true and that he had simply lost the election. The witnesses Monday, mostly all Republicans and many testifying in pre-recorded videos, described in blunt terms and sometimes exasperated detail how Trump refused to take the advice of those closest to him, including his family members. As the people around him splintered into a, quote, team normal, headed by former campaign manager Bill Stepien and others, led by Trump confidant Rudy Giuliani, the president chose his sides. On election night, Stepien said Trump was, quote, going increasingly unhappy and refusing to accept the grim outlook. Son-in-law Jared Kushner tried to steer Trump away from Attorney Giuliani and his far-flung theories of voter fraud that advisors believed were not true. The president would have none of it. The back and forth intensified in the run-up to January 6. Former Justice Department official Richard Donahue recalled breaking down one claim after another, from a truckload of ballots in Pennsylvania to a missing suitcase of ballots in Georgia, and telling Trump, much of the info you're getting is false. Still, Trump pressed on with his false claims, even after dozens of court cases collapsed. The panel also provided new information about how Trump's fundraising machine collected some $250 million with his campaigns to Stop the Steal and others in the aftermath of the November election, mostly from small-dollar donations from gullible Americans. One plea for cash went out 30 minutes before the January 6, 2021 insurrection. Quote, not only was there a big lie, there was the big ripoff, said Representative Zoe Lofgren, a Democrat from California. Chairman Rob Benny Thompson, a Democrat from Mississippi, opened Monday's hearing saying Trump, quote, betrayed the trust of the American people and tried to remain in office when people had voted him out, unquote. As the hearings play out for the public, they are also being watched by one of the most important viewers, Attorney General Merrick Garland, who must decide whether his department can and should prosecute Trump. No sitting or former president has ever faced such an indictment. Quote, I am watching, Garland said Monday at a press briefing at the Justice Department, even if he may not watch all the hearings live. Quote, and I can assure you that the January 6 prosecutors are watching all of the hearings as well, unquote. Biden was getting updates, but not watching blow by blow, said White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre. Stepien was to be key in-person witness Monday, but abruptly backed out of appearing live because his wife went into labor. Stepien, who is still close to Trump, had been subpoenaed to appear. He is now a top campaign advisor to the Trump-endorsed House candidate Harriet Hedgman, who is challenging committee vice chair Representative Liz Cheney in Wyoming Republican primary. The panel marched ahead after a morning scramble and delay, with witness after witness saying Trump latched onto and repeated false claims about the election, although those closest to him told him the theories of stolen ballots or rigged voting machines were simply not true. Stepien and senior advisor Jason Miller described how the festive mood at the White House on election night turned grim as Fox News announced Trump had lost the state of Arizona to Joe Biden, and aides worked to counsel Trump on what to do next. But he ignored their advice, choosing to listen instead to Giuliani, who was described as inebriated by several witnesses. Giuliani issued a general denial on Monday, rejecting, quote, all falsehoods he said were being said about him. Stepien said, quote, my belief, my recommendation, was to say that votes were still being counted It's too early to tell, too early to call the race. Unquote. Barr, who had also testified in last week's blockbuster hearing, said that Trump was as mad as I've ever seen him when the Attorney General later explained that the Justice Department would not take sides in the election. For the past year, the committee has been investigating the most violent attack on the Capitol since the War of 1812, which some believe posed a great threat to democracy. Monday's hearing also featured live witnesses, including Chris Steigerwalt, a former Fox News Channel political editor, who declared on election night that Arizona was being won by Biden. Also appearing was the former U.S. attorney in Atlanta, B.J. Pack, who abruptly resigned after Trump pressured Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, to find enough votes to overturn his defeat. Now we have a story filed by Aaron Murphy of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau, Grassley and Ernst taking wait-and-see approach on proposed gun legislation. And the story begins with a photograph of U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley as he visits with constituents on June 3rd at Lincoln Savings Bank in Waterloo. Dateline Des Moines. Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, Iowa's Republican U.S. senators, are waiting to see the final version of bipartisan legislation containing modest gun control proposals before stating whether they will support it. The legislation was the result of 2 weeks of negotiations between a bipartisan group of U.S. senators in response to recent mass shootings in the United States. But Grassley, who is up for re-election this fall, said he was encouraged to see the bipartisan group produce a proposal. The proposal would make juvenile records available during background checks whenever someone under the age of 21 buys a gun, ban convicted domestic abusers from being able to buy a gun, and send federal fundraising to states enacting so-called red flag laws, which attempt to temporarily take guns away from individuals who could be considered potentially violent. Quote, I'm encouraged to see the bipartisan group of senators making headway on the important issues of mental health, school safety, and curtailing gun violence, Grassley said in a statement. As always, I need to see legislative text, which has yet to be written, before making a final decision on how I'd vote, he said. I've said from the start that as we work toward improving safety, it's important that we safeguard rights enshrined in the Constitution and Bill of Rights, unquote. Ernst spokesman Brendan Conley echoed Grassley's wait-and-see approach. Quote, while this is currently only an outline of general and unspecific proposals, Senator Ernst will evaluate the specifics of any legislation when there is a bill text to do so, Conley said in an email to the Des Moines Bureau. Ernst, in the past, has opposed similar language called the boyfriend loophole to ban domestic abusers from buying a gun. Ernst, who has said she was a victim of domestic violence, objected to a legislative proposal that would have retroactively classified assault convictions as felonies and barred those convicted from owning or buying guns. Quote, simply disallowing people due process is not what we want to see, Ernst said in 2019. Quote, I think there are great ways to protect survivors in a way that doesn't strip away people's rights, unquote. The proposed legislation announced over the weekend does not reach as far on gun control as Democrats have called for, but many Democrats nonetheless praised the work done by the bipartisan group in an effort to achieve some action on gun regulations after decades of inaction amid dozens of mass shootings in schools, churches, and other public spaces. U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, a Democrat from Connecticut, a member of the bipartisan group that is putting together the gun violence bill, said it represents, quote, real meaningful progress and breaks a 30-year logjam demonstrating that Democrats and Republicans can work together in a way that truly saves lives, unquote. Quote, will this bill do everything we need to end our nation's gun violence epidemic? No. But it's real, meaningful progress, Murphy said in a social media post after the bipartisan deal was announced. There is not yet a timeline for when the legislation will be drafted and considered in the U.S. Senate. In his Monday response, Grassley also cited legislation he previously introduced, supported by his own bipartisan group of senators. The Eagles Act, he said, would expand the U.S. Secret Service's National Threat Assessment Center to include a greater focus on school violence prevention. Next, Andy Malone files this story, Cedar Falls Historical Society making fresh fundraising push for a new museum. Dateline Cedar Falls. COVID-19 halted the Cedar Falls Historical Society's plans to raise a couple of million dollars for a new two-story museum at 315 Clay Street. That unforeseen pandemic, as well as a higher-than-expected construction cost estimate, were the surprises that led to the nonprofit to what is now a $2.5 million project, a fresh new fundraising push, and a tentative 2024 date for breaking ground, Executive Director Carrie Ildertz said on Monday. A $1.82 million capital campaign first kicked off in 2017. Mayor Rob Green proclaimed last week to be Iowa Museum Week in Cedar Falls. At the June 6th City Council meeting, he shared the Historical Society's plans to embark on a second $1.5 million campaign and encouraged residents to celebrate by visiting the area's 14 local museums and support future efforts. Quote, the plans for the Home for Our History campaign include renovating the main floor of the building into a large classroom. Board President Dave Welter told the City Council, quote, so that the Historical Society can accommodate larger groups, incorporate interactive exhibits, and STEM concepts to tell our city's history. Plans also include building, quote, an addition to the property that'll house a new two-story museum that celebrates business, industry, agriculture, and transportation here in Cedar Falls, as well as puts on a permanent display of the Lenoir train exhibit. Quote, we believe a successful campaign to complete the addition and renovations at 315 Clay will allow Cedar Falls Historical Society to tell our city's story in a way that we've never been able to do so before and give residents a source of pride and place within our community, he said. The Historical Society acquired the building and necessary parcels, at one time home to a well-known law office, for $435,000 in September of 2016. It was, quote, too perfect to pass up at the time, Ildert said. The building is two doors down from its home base, the Victorian House Museum at 308 West 3rd Street. The Society launched its original Connect and Protect campaign in 2017. The fundraising goal was $1.825 million at the time, with hopes of starting construction on the renovation and new rear addition facing Franklin Street in late 2019. Ildert said at the time, more would be raised to furnish the interiors and pay for exhibits. Ildert said Monday that first campaign raised about $1 million before the world shut down because of COVID-19. Organizers approached a number of potential contractors in 2019 and eventually settled on Waterloo-based Peters Construction Corporation. It then got the unfortunate news that the quote was higher than anticipated. Now, Ildert said, volunteers are in the very early stages of reaching out to potential donors. Volunteers may look to formally announce a more public second campaign in the fall, with hopes of raising the $1.5 million by the end of 2023. The entire $2.5 million estimated cost includes the land acquisition. Ildert's said the Historical Society is continuing to work on the design, but the plans are pretty much the same as they were before the pandemic. Welter said at the council meeting, the building has already been renovated so that the Historical Society's entire collection can be stored in a climate-controlled setting, unquote. Ildert's noted, the new museum will double the amount of classroom space from a 40 to an 80-person occupancy for large school groups and other audiences. The additional space also will be put toward interactive exhibits and cater to the growth of its artifact collections, everything from historical clothing to toys to yearbooks and city directories. Quote, if people want more information, they're welcome to give us a call or go to our website to learn more, Eldert said. Now we turn the page to the Cedar Valley section. College Hill Arts Festival returns to Cedar Falls Friday and Saturday. Story filed by Melody Parker. Dateline Cedar Falls. Back to basics. That's how Doug Johnson is describing the 42nd College Hill Arts Festival. The popular event returns Friday and Saturday to its place on the lawn at 23rd and College Streets after a two-year hiatus because of COVID-19. The event is from noon to 8 p.m. Friday and 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday on the University of Northern Iowa campus. There is no admission fee. Quote, it's going to be a little different this year. It's great to have the festival back, but it's not quite going to be what it was 3 years ago. We've needed to make some cuts, which is why we're getting back to basics, back to what's most important about the festival, and that is the artists, said Johnson, who is co-chairing the festival with Rob Swately. Quote, we want to make sure that part of the festival is back to what it's always been. People will enjoy getting out to see and purchase artwork and talk with the artists and enjoy the super weather we're going to have this weekend, unquote. Absent will be the performing arts stage. Quote, part of it is financial, not having had the festival in 2 years, and part of it is the loss of volunteers, Johnson explained. There are about 24 volunteers committed to this year's festival. Quote, we need volunteers, said Swately. CHAF is an all-volunteer festival, but many volunteers have aged out, and, since COVID, some people may not feel comfortable volunteering at large events, he noted. Quote, I'm hearing from other event organizers that volunteering is down, and everyone is having a hard time finding people to volunteer, unquote. It's also been more difficult to find sponsors able to financially support the festival. Quote, my concern has been going to businesses who are struggling to keep their doors open and ask them to make this festival happen. That's another reason we've cut back this year. Approximately 65 artists will exhibit and sell their original artwork in open-air booths. Categories include jewelry, sculpture, painting, pastel, ceramics, graphics, printmaking, mixed media, fiber, photography, glass, and wood. It's a juried event. The festival has been a signature event for Iowa and was named one of the top 100 best fine arts and design shows in the U.S. by Sunshine Artist. Gary Kelly's posters promoting the festival have won numerous national awards. Quote, our community has embraced the festival over the last 40-plus years because of the artists and their work. They're good supporters of the arts. That's why we thought it was important to come back this year and step back to basics, Johnson said. Next, we have a story submitted by Maria Cooper, and it begins with a photograph of young children playing in a water fountain. Waterloo promotes cooling stations during hot weather. Dateline Waterloo. Temperatures could reach as high as 100 degrees Fahrenheit Tuesday and stay around 90 degrees the rest of the week. High humidity is also in the forecast because of rising dew points. To beat the heat, the city of Waterloo has announced a number of cooling stations the public can use this week. And here's a list of those stations. Waterloo Center for the Arts at 225 Commercial Street from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Waterloo Public Library at 415 Commercial Street from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Thursday and 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Friday and Saturday. Waterloo Regional Airport at 2790 Livingston Lane from 5 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Friday. And we continue the list of cooling stations in the area. Young Arena, 125 Commercial Street, from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. Thursday and Friday. Mark's Park Spray Pad, free for kids 12 and under, at 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Burns Pool, 801 Campbell Avenue, $5 for ages 2 and up, $2 for under 2, 1 to 5 p.m. daily. Gates Pool, 620 East Donald Street, $5 for ages 2 and up, $2 for under 2, Monday through Friday, 1 to 4:30 p.m., 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. And Sportsplex Pool, 300 Jefferson Street, $5 Tuesday and Thursday, 2 to 4 p.m., Saturday and Sunday, 12:30 to 2:30 p.m. Signs of heat exhaustion include headache, cramps, lack of sweating, and vomiting. To avoid heat exhaustion, Waterloo Fire Rescue advises people to stay well hydrated, avoid extraneous exercise outdoors, minimize alcohol or caffeine consumption, and take frequent breaks in the shade or air conditioning. People should also wear loose, lightweight, and light-colored clothing. The city also encourages people to keep pets indoors and hydrated. Next, filed by Jeff Reinitz, Waterloo man arrested after allegedly firing pistol. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo man has been arrested for allegedly firing a handgun in a neighborhood over the weekend. Police arrested Devonner Coleman, 54, on charges of felon in possession of a firearm, carrying weapons, and reckless use of a firearm. He was also arrested for possession of marijuana with intent to deliver and violation of the Drug Tax Stamp Act. He was released pending trial. According to court records, residents called 911 around 2:50 a.m. after hearing gunshots. Officers found four 45 caliber spent shell casings near the porch of Coleman's home at 1021 West 5th Street. Police searched his home and found a 45 caliber SDS Imports Model 1911 pistol in a cooler in the basement. Police also found a vacuum-sealed bag with more than 42 grams of marijuana and digital scales. Authorities allege Coleman is prohibited from handling firearms because of prior domestic assault and operating while intoxicated convictions. Next, Cedar Falls police seized stolen gun and one is detained. Dateline Cedar Falls. Cedar Falls police arrested a man after finding a stolen gun early Sunday. According to court records, Cedar Falls officers found Javon Isaiah Middleton, 24, as he was entering Benai's convenience store on College Street around 12:10 a.m. in connection with an Iowa City weapons investigation. Middleton allegedly gave police a fake name, and officers found he was carrying a 45 caliber Springfield SDS pistol in his coat pocket. Officers determined the weapon had been reported stolen in Burlington, according to court records. Middleton was arrested for carrying weapons, harassment of a public official, and fourth-degree theft. He was also detained on outstanding probation warrants. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Wednesday, June 15th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Richard Doc Allen Jones, 75, passed away on June 11, 2022, at home surrounded by his loving family. A celebration of life open house will take place at a later date. Richard was born June 21, 1946, in Frederick, Maryland. He graduated from Frederick High School, and he received a Bachelor of Arts degree in biology from Hood College. He earned a certificate in cardiopulmonary technology from North Hennepin Community College and worked as a perfusionist the majority of his 33-year career at Allen Memorial Hospital before retiring in 2013. Richard married Mary on July 7, 1973 in Frederick, Maryland. Richard enjoyed many hobbies during his life, ranging from breeding and raising Dalmatians, playing golf, Civil War reenactment, collecting wine and scotch, leather working, camping, cooking, playing with his grandkids and neighborhood kids, playing the mandolin and banjo, and fishing. He was truly a jack of all trades and went all in for each hobby. His family will remember him most for his creative antics, mischief, jokes, and sarcasm. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made in Richard's memory to the Allen Memorial Heart Foundation and Allen Hospice. Online condolences may be directed to the family at www.iowacremation.com under obituaries. Ted Mellon, age 80, of Stout, Iowa, passed away at Mercy One in Cedar Falls, Iowa, on Saturday, June 11, 2022, of natural causes. A celebration of life is set for July 23, 2022, at the Cedar Falls Eagles Club, 2124 Lone Tree Road, Cedar Falls, Iowa, from 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. Dale M. Ruber, 70, of Westgate, Iowa, died on Friday, June 10, 2022, at Allen Hospital in Waterloo. Funeral service will be at 2 p.m. Wednesday, June 15, 2022, at St. Peter Lutheran Church in Westgate. Visitation will be from 3 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday, and for 1 hour before the funeral on Wednesday at St. Peter Lutheran Church in Westgate. Interment will be at St. Peter Cemetery in Westgate, Iowa. Jameson Smith's funeral home in Maynard is assisting the family. Online obituary can be found at www.jamesonsmithsfuneralhome.com. Dale is survived by his wife, Mary Ruber, daughter Rayanne, spouse Jared Gordon of Center Point, and his son Darren Ruber of Westgate, 5 grandchildren and 9 siblings. Ryan Daniel Breitbach, 49, of Lake Park, passed away on Tuesday, June 7, 2022, at his home in Lake Park. Visitation will be held Wednesday, June 15, from 4:30 to 7 o'clock p.m. at the Lake Park Fire Department. Military and firefighter honors will be held at 5 p.m. A memorial service will be held Friday, June 17, at 2 o'clock p.m., with a visitation 1 hour prior to the service at the Trinity United Methodist Church in Waverly, Iowa. Arrangements are under the direction of the Schuchert Lentz Funeral Home in Spirit Lake. Online condolences may be sent to www.spiritlakefuneralhome.com. Now here the courier lists 5 death notices. Leah E. Cook, 98, of Winthrop, died Saturday, June 11, 2022, at Buchanan County Medical Center in Independence. Arrangements are with Fawcett Smith's Funeral Home in Winthrop. Mary Joy Harms, 98, of Eldora, died Thursday, June 9, 2022, at her home in Eldora. Arrangements are with Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service, Krebs Chapel in Eldora. Ellen Darlene Boers McCrea, 100, of Eldora, died Thursday, June 9, 2022, at Ramsey Village in Des Moines, Iowa. Arrangements are with Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service in Eldora. Carol Noreem, 85, of Iowa Falls, died Saturday, June 11, 2022, at Grand Gervonta Ackley. Arrangements are with Council Woodley Funeral Home of Iowa Falls. And Don E. Swanson, 92, of Hudson, died Saturday, June 11, 2022, at his home. Arrangements are with Locke at Tower Park. Now we're back to reading articles. In January 6 cases, one judge stands out. Story filed by the Associated Press. And it begins with a photograph taken of insurrectionists loyal to President Donald Trump as they breach the Capitol on January 6th in Washington. An Ohio couple climbed through a broken window of the U.S. Capitol and live-streamed a video of themselves inside. A Texas mortgage broker posed for a selfie in front of rioters breaching the building. An Indiana hair salon owner celebrated on Facebook a day after she joined the pro-Donald Trump mob. Federal prosecutors did not seek prison time for any of them after they pleaded guilty to petty offenses for their actions on January 6, 2021. The judge had other ideas. U.S. District Court Judge Tanya Chutkan put them all behind bars, describing it as the appropriate punishment for their participation in the riot that halted the certification of President Joe Biden's victory, sent lawmakers running for their lives, and left dozens of police officers beaten and bloodied, as the number of people sentenced for crimes in the insurrection nears 200, an Associated Press analysis of sentencing data shows that some judges are divided over how to punish the rioters, particularly for the low-level misdemeanors arising from the attack. Quote, "We're asking judges to do what they think is right, and they don't agree on what's right," said Greg Hunter, a lawyer defending several January 6th defendants. A House committee that held its first public hearing on Thursday cast a wide net in its investigation of the insurrection, examining how the disgraced former President Trump and his allies tried to undermine the election results. So far, the Justice Department's criminal investigation has focused primarily on the hundreds of Trump supporters who broke through police barricades, shattered windows, attacked officers, and stormed into the Capitol. Chutkan, a former assistant public defender who was nominated to the bench by President Barack Obama, has consistently taken the hardest line on January 6 defendants of any judge serving on Washington's federal trial court, which is handling the more than 800 cases brought so far in the largest prosecution in Justice Department history. Chutkan has handed out tougher sentences than the department was seeking in 7 cases, matched its request in 4 others, and sent all 11 riot defendants who have come before her behind bars. In the 4 cases in which prosecutors did not seek jail time, Chutkan gave terms ranging from 14 days to 45 days. Overall, the 20 judges who have sentenced riot defendants have given lighter sentences than prosecutors were seeking in almost 3/4 of the cases. The judges exceeded prosecutors' recommendation for about 10% of the defendants, according to AP's analysis. While some judges have sentenced few January 6 defendants, no other judge besides Chutkan exceeded prosecutors' recommended punishment in most of the cases assigned to them. Quote, "Depending on the judge you get, the same facts could get you anything from probation to months in jail," said Hunter, the defense lawyer. In one case, 2 friends from Indiana, Donna Sue Bissey and Anna Morgan Lloyd, both pleaded guilty to the same misdemeanor offense for engaging in essentially the same conduct inside the Capitol. Prosecutors did not seek jail time for either, noting their lack of a criminal record. Chutkan sentenced Bissey to 14 days in jail. A different judge sentenced Bissey's friend to probation. While Judge Royce Lamberth did not send Morgan Lloyd to jail, he has also been among the toughest judges on defendants. In one case, Lamberth, who was nominated by President Ronald Reagan, gave a Pennsylvania man 2 months behind bars for a misdemeanor when prosecutors were seeking only 2 weeks. More than 300 people have pleaded guilty in connection with the insurrection to crimes ranging from misdemeanors to felony seditious conspiracy. 5 others have been convicted at trial. A judge decided 2 other cases without a jury, acquitting one defendant and partially acquitting the other. The January 6 cases pose a unique challenge for judges in that even though the riot was unlike anything the country has seen before, hundreds of people were charged only with misdemeanors, such as illegal entry, that typically do not land first-time offenders behind bars. To be sure, every case and defendant is different. In the case of a Maryland man who sprayed a fire extinguisher at officers defending the Capitol, prosecutors sought more than 4 years in prison. But Judge Randolph Moss sentenced Matthew Ryan Miller to less than 3 years, noting that the man was just 22 years old on January 6, 2021, was intoxicated when he stormed the Capitol, and has shown remorse. Before handing down the punishment, Moss said he believes judges have done a good job at ensuring the punishments are consistent while also weighing the individual factors of each case. Quote, when one looks at these sentencing decisions that have been made by this court across many judges, it's remarkable how consistent sentencing has been, said Moss, an Obama nominee. When I see differences, I am able to go back through the record and look at it and understand the basis for those differences, unquote. On the Nation and World page, we have a story written by Stan Choi of the Associated Press. Bear market is official. At the center of the sell-off was Fed's efforts to combat inflation. Dateline New York. Wall Street tumbled into what's called a bear market Monday after fears about a fragile economy and rising interest rates sent the Standard & Poor's 500 more than 20% below its record set this year. The index sank 3.9% in the first chance for investors to trade after getting the weekend to reflect on the stunning news that inflation is getting worse, not better. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was briefly down more than 1,000 points before finishing with a loss of 876. At the center of the sell-off, again, was the Federal Reserve, which is scrambling to get inflation under control. Its main method to do that is to raise interest rates in order to slow the economy, a blunt tool that risks a recession if used too aggressively. With the Fed seemingly pinned into having to get more aggressive, prices fell in a worldwide rout for everything from bonds to Bitcoin, from New York to New Zealand. Some of the sharpest drops hit what had been winners of the easier low-rate era, such as high-growth technology stocks and other former darlings of investors. Tesla slumped 7.1%, and Amazon dropped 5.5%. GameStop tumbled 8.4%. Quote, the best thing people can do is to not panic and don't sell at the bottom, said Randy Frederick, managing director of trading and derivatives at Schwab Center for Financial Research. And we're probably not at the bottom, unquote. Some economists are speculating the Fed on Wednesday may raise its key rate by 0.75 percentage point. That's triple the usual amount, and something the Fed hasn't done since 1994. Traders now see a 28% probability of such a mega hike, up from just 3% a week ago, according to CME Group. No one thinks the Fed will stop there, with markets bracing for a continued series of bigger-than-usual hikes. Those would come on top of some discouraging signals about the economy and corporate profits, including a record-low preliminary reading on consumer sentiment soured by high gasoline prices. The economy is holding up overall, but the danger is that the job market and other factors are so hot that they will feed into higher inflation. That's why the Fed is in the midst of a whiplash pivot away from the record low interest rates it engineered earlier in the pandemic. Wall Street's sobering realization that inflation is accelerating, not peaking, is also sending U.S. bond yields to their highest levels in more than a decade. The two-year Treasury bond shot to 3.36% from 3.06% late Friday, in its second straight major move. Next, we have a story filed by Aaron Murphy of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. State School Safety Bureau gets boost from $100 million infusion of federal funds. Dateline Des Moines. School districts in Iowa will have access to more resources designed to help prevent school violence thanks to $100 million in federal pandemic relief funding Governor Kim Reynolds is putting into the state's School Safety Bureau. Reynolds announced the move Tuesday during a news conference at the state public safety offices near the Iowa Capitol complex. The resources will include state personnel, training, and emergency communication systems, all designed to help schools prevent violence or react to emergency events like school shootings. The dedication of federal funding to State School Safety Bureau comes in the wake of multiple new mass shootings across the United States in elementary schools, churches, and other public spaces. Quote, every family should be able to confidently send their children to school, knowing that they will be safe, Reynolds said during the news conference. Quote, and as the governor of Iowa and a grandmother of school-aged children, I want to assure parents that your children's safety at school is just as important to me, unquote. Reynolds said more than $80 million will go toward conducting vulnerability assessments at school buildings and creating grants for districts to make any recommended physical changes or upgrades. Iowa Department of Public Safety Commissioner Stephen Bayens said the goal of the School Safety Bureau is prevention. One of the new bureau positions made possible by the federal funding will monitor threats being made through digital sources. Quote, the goal is to identify concerning behaviors early so parents, school officials, mental health professionals, and others can begin providing assistance with and without the need for having formal law enforcement intervention, Bayan said at the news conference. The Bureau also will make emergency radio systems available to any school that wants one and will create a program through which individuals can anonymously report to the Bureau via phone, website, or mobile app concerning behavior. Bayan said the Bureau's resources will supplement any efforts already underway at Iowa school districts and not duplicate or supplant those efforts. Quote, I wish we could say this is all unnecessary, but we cannot simply rely on the optimistic thought that it will never happen here in Iowa, Bayan said. Quote, rather, reality mandates that we roll up our sleeves and we tackle this issue head on. We owe it to our kids. We owe it to our teachers. We owe it to our communities. And we will do everything in our power to put action behind the prayer that it'll never happen here, unquote. Reynolds created the School Safety Bureau in January 2020, but the Republican-majority Iowa legislature has not funded the Bureau in the three legislative sessions since. Reynolds on Tuesday announced she will use funding from two federal pandemic relief packages, one each passed under the disgraced former President Donald Trump and the current President Joe Biden. Reynolds said the School Safety Bureau was established despite the lack of state funding and that state government officials from various state agencies have been working to make the Bureau as useful as possible. Quote, the lack of state funding hasn't stopped us from doing some stuff, Reynolds said. We didn't get the funding, so we haven't stood it up in a manner that it needed to be stood up. But now we will be able to, which I think is wonderful use of some of the funds that are coming into the state, unquote. Reynolds said the $100 million infusion of federal funding will sustain the School Safety Bureau through 2026, and it could be funded even longer, pending new gun control, school safety, and mental health care in legislation being considered in Congress. In the meantime, she will work with state legislators to ensure the Bureau is funded long-term. She said once the federal funding is exhausted, her office estimates it will cost $1.5 million annually to operate the Bureau. Next is a story filed by Maria Cooper. Waterloo Board approves starting girls' wrestling teams at East and West High Schools. Dateline Waterloo. Students in Waterloo Community Schools now have the option to join more sports teams after Monday's Board of Education meeting. The board approved the formation of girls' wrestling teams at East and West High Schools. Until now, girls were allowed to compete by joining the boys' teams. Anthony Watson will be one of the head coaches. He's currently the assistant wrestling coach at East. He says four girls are already signed up for next school year. The Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union sanctioned girls' wrestling in January. Their first sanctioned season will begin in the 2022-23 school year. There are currently 59 schools in Iowa with a girls' team. the team will follow the National Federation of State High School Associations wrestling rules and guidelines. The season's format, classification system, weight class, postseason, and tournament details are still being finalized. Middle school students will also have the chance to join a new sport now that both soccer and swim programs will be available to the 7th and 8th graders. The board also gave approval to those new offerings. Last fall, the district's four middle schools piloted a soccer program. Athletic directors and coaches saw a need for a fully formed program after more than 100 students participated. High school soccer coach Mike Penning helped lead the program and saw kids who wouldn't normally go out for sports play the game. Prior to the pilot, there were only club programs and travel teams that were outside of school available to district students. The season will take place in October with 2 weeks of practice and four jamboree dates. Penning and District Athletics and Activities Director Dan Huff said there are some facility needs that must be addressed in the future. Still, they're happy with where we're at, unquote. Huff said sixth graders wouldn't be part of the teams because state associations don't allow sixth graders to participate in junior high sports. However, there are extramural opportunities for them. As for the new swim team, the season will be 4 weeks long, running from mid-February to mid-March. Next, we have Juneteenth celebration, bringing weekend of fun to Waterloo. Dateline Waterloo. A longtime festival celebrating Waterloo's Black community will bring music, food, and lots of fun to Gates Park and other locations this weekend. Juneteenth events, all of them free, kick off Friday and continue through Sunday. Organizers are also promoting other African-American-focused events during the month and tying them to the holiday. This is the 27th year Juneteenth has been marked with public events in Waterloo, organizers say. The holiday commemorates the liberation of the last slaves in Texas on June 19, 1865. It was 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation abolished slavery in the Confederate States in 1863 that Black people in Galveston, Texas, learned they were free from arriving Union soldiers. Last year, President Joe Biden recognized Juneteenth as a federal holiday. The day has been recognized in Iowa since 2002, after a proclamation from former Governor Tom Vilsack. Quote, I don't think people at the time really recognized it, even though it was a state holiday. But now that it is a federal holiday, it takes it to a whole other level, said LaTanya Graves, director of the Waterloo NAACP. Quote, our ancestors were enslaved, brought over against their will, and for so many years, discriminated against at every level, which still continues today, she noted. But to have our celebration to recognize the federal holiday is just awesome. It's a long time coming, unquote. The events kick off with an African attire fashion show at 8 p.m. Friday at Absalom Lounge. Prizes for the first through third places will be awarded. The celebration continues Saturday at Gates Park with music, food, and games from 1 to 7 p.m. Graves said many food stands and small businesses will be at the event, along with health and financial vendors. The classic car show is returning as well. This year, there will be a separate car show solely for Corvettes. Each category will receive first through third place prizes. The NAACP is also holding a 5K walk at the park. At 5 p.m., there will be a concert featuring Felicia Smith Knowles. In addition, Graves said, a reading of names for victims of violence will take place. On Saturday, things start at 10 a.m. with church services at Gates Park. The three churches participating include Impact Church of Hope, Faith Temple Baptist Church, and Cathedral of Faith Baptist Church. Also, Sunday is an opportunity for residents to meet their city council members at the park. To close out the weekend, there will be a basketball league starting at 4 p.m. for adults over 30. Although Juneteenth is this weekend, local leaders planned free events for the entire month of June to celebrate the holiday. At 8:30 a.m. June 23rd, a Vitality Conference sponsored by 24/7 BLAC will take place at the Waterloo Convention Center. Keynote speakers include Omar Brown, Senior Vice President and People and Culture Officer for the Big Ten Conference, and Andre M. Perry, a Senior Fellow at Brookings Metro. At 6 p.m., a networking event will take place at the Convention Center featuring the band Heartsmith and 24/7 Black's Black Business and Entrepreneurship Accelerator. From 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. June 24th, there will be leadership lessons with SHIPHT and Humanize My Hoodie at the Convention Center. SHIPHT focuses on creating leaders in tech, business, entrepreneurship, and the public sector. At 7 p.m., Andrew Wright of the Wright House of Fashion and Matthew Gilbert of Iowa Core will host a screening of the documentary film Black Liberation Space at Walnut Street Baptist Church. At 4 p.m. June 25th, the Cedar Valley Fashion, Art, and Culture Expo, as well as the SHIPHT and Cedar Valley Fine Arts Center Expo, will be held at Young Arena. The event will be hosted by Black Ink's Ryan Henry and MTV's Wild and Out star Blair Christian. On June 29th, an exhibit is opening at the Grout Museum called the Black Stories Collective. The museum is open from 10 a.m. to 4 o'clock p.m. And that does it, friends, for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, June 15th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.